In this week's episode of the First Moves podcast, we're talking to Anirudh Rajesh, the CEO and co-founder of Astrarium, a biotech company that uses genetically modified bacteria to solve our water scarcity problem in today's world. In this episode, we'll be discussing his love for genetics. And if you want to learn how you can turn scientific ideas into viable businesses, this episode is for you. So please give it a listen.
Ani, welcome to the show. Could you please share how you ended up in Maastricht?
First of all, thank you, Sebastian and Stein, for having me on the podcast. Very excited to be here. And as to how I ended up in Maastricht, so I'm Ani. Hello, everyone. I'm from India, and I did my high school in Slovenia, actually. And there I was looking at universities to go to, and I was looking at programs because I was interested in genetics and molecular biology from a very young age. And Maastricht Science Program seemed cool because it's a research-based program, and also because I knew I wanted to do genetics, but not specifically what in genetics. And at MSP, you can do a wide variety of courses, and I wanted to explore also the math aspects, the chemistry aspects too, and figure out what I wanted to do. So that's how I ended up in Maastricht with the MSP program.
Very cool. And how has that experience gone for you over the last few years?
I just graduated from MSP, and it was a very, very useful experience, especially because when I compare my experience with like other high school friends that I had who had similar interests and went to other universities, comparatively, the course at MSP is very hands-on, especially with the problem-based learning at Maastricht University and the research-based learning at MSP. And I have much more lab experience than I would say most of my friends across the world with the other programs. So yeah, that's how it's shaped my research experience.
And then how did you actually end up on that track in the first place? So MSP is kind of one stone in that path. What led you on that path in the first place? Where did that interest in genetics come from?
We will talk about this later again. It was a personal possession. But basically, when I was very young, I used to read a lot of books. And there's this one book that I picked up. And since then, I watched a bunch of YouTube videos. Some YouTubers like Bozeman Science, Khan Academy, all of these YouTube channels. And then I watched how genetics can be used and how genes are the blueprint of life. And if I change it, then something completely different happens, and I can basically do different cool stuff like making a cat glow. And when I was very young, so like 13-14, I wanted to make humans fly. It's not really practical. As I grew older, I got to know about it, but that was one of my funny aims that I had, and to use genetics to make humans evolve into something different. And since then, that's how I came into the track of genetics.
Very cool. And then, I mean, this is, of course, leading up to probably one of the main questions of today, which is about a startup, and it's your startup, and it's called Astrarium. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about what Astrarium is?
Yes, of course. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Astrarium, and at Astrarium, what we do is we use bioengineered bacteria to remove the salt from seawater, so there's fresh water which is present all year round for agriculture, drinking, and more.
How did your journey at MSP actually lead you into co-founding Astrarium?
So basically, there was this competition called iGEM, International Genetically Engineered Machine. And this competition is where universities around the world compete, where and use genetics to solve a very important problem in the world. This competition originated from MIT in the US, and now they conduct it every year at Paris. And so I applied for this competition. And for this competition, you have to bring out your own idea. So in the application, you're supposed to give out your own idea. And then there's this professor, Eric, at the university, and he picks 10 applications every year, and he forms a team. He usually takes second years, but somehow I got in as a first year. And basically, they chose my idea of using bacteria to remove salt for water scarcity for the project. And the idea, I chose this idea because I am originally from India, as I said, and I've seen water scarcity in person, where even in like the very posh places too, if there was no water, there were summer months where every day water will be only available 1 hour per day. So the taps can only be used for 1 hour, independent of where you're from, because there was such a big drought. And since I've experienced this, I was like, can I use something that I'm interested in, so genetics, to actually change this condition? Then went through literature, came up with this idea, applied to the competition. And then after the applications, everyone discussed the ideas and chose my idea to continue. The idea worked, and now we're converting it into a startup. So that's how it started from MSP.
That's a very nice story, actually, that you go from being a student to being picked and your idea gets picked. How was the experience going to Paris with this whole idea?
It was amazing because there were close to, I think, 4,000, 5,000 people from all around the world, from like Australia to the US, so everywhere in between Japan, with so many stands. And it was basically like leaving a kid in a candy store, because I'm interested in genetics and people are using genetics for a variety of things, and how they use synthetic biology to make practical real world changes was actually very cool. So the experience was great. In the end, we got a silver medal, which has also helped us with the project.
I mean, coming from such a large amount of people to then winning a silver medal, I think that's already quite an achievement and quite like a nice push of motivation to then really continue working on it. How did your kind of decision-making process start? Because it was going to this competition, solving a really big issue, which you had seen the effects of. How did your mindset maybe change from, oh, this is just a competition, to something I want to build over the long run? What was that like?
So towards the end of the competition, a couple of us were like, everyone was discussing, and a couple of us wanted to take this further, because now it was a lab proof of concept, but we actually wanted to bring this technology to the world, because when we saw the results that we got from the lab, spoiler alert, we are about 5 times energy efficient and half as expensive compared to the best desalination methods right now. And we were like, let's not leave it to a lab idea and published paper, but actually bring it out where we can take it around the world and make a change in people's lives. So since the end of the project, we decided that. However, we really didn't have a path to take, and we faced a bunch of obstacles in the way, and through that, we're here right now.
What kind of obstacles did you go through? Could you mention some of these and maybe the impact they had on where Strarium is now?
Of course, several obstacles, I would say, but each obstacle has made us better, not worse, definitely. And for the first obstacles, we actually, at the competition, we're around 12 to 14 people, and we were all technical. So the biggest first obstacle that we had was finalizing a team and also having those uncomfortable shareholder conversations, deciding how much percentage each person gets. Because up until that point, everyone had given their blood, sweat, and tears for this project, and we see a path towards it actually getting commercialized. So those conversations had to be held. We also had to get a bunch of people for the financial side, because we were also very technical team. So that was one of the first obstacles. And another one, as I said, was at that point we were all very technical people. And business, although we had some idea, we were not really experienced with the business, economics, finances, whatever. And this is where I would be very grateful to the Maastricht Entrepreneurship Center, because they sent us to a bunch of incubators in Berlin, in Antwerp, and also the talks that we had with Roy and also Hugo in the Brightlands Camelot campus, Leof and everyone helped us shape this idea from a school project to actually a business, thinking about how we would make money so that we're profitable, because at the end of the day, really, will not be an NGO. We want to also support ourselves through the startup. So yeah, those were some of the early obstacles that we faced, and going through them has helped us understand the business world and understanding the how to approach the market, go-to-market strategy, and all of those things, basically.
So how have these institutions then helped you getting to the point where you're ready to commercialize it, or you have a plan on how to commercialize this?
So the institutions, as in Maastricht University, we joined the Maastricht University Challenge first in 2022, where we were a bunch of students who didn't know anything about business, having these uncomfortable conversations in the background, and going through these workshops, and then learning about how to raise money, how to think about who our customer is, how to actually scale a model from a lab size start from lab scale to actually industrial scale. how much money we would require, because we were like, we would need 10 million to do this. Of course, that is not the way to go. We have to break it down to steps and think about what is the next milestone, what is the milestone after that, and then thinking about what we can start with instead of us just being like, we need the money and only then we can start. You can do market research any time of the day. You can go talk to people, have those cold calls, which are really daunting in the beginning, but at some point you get immune to them. So going through the Maastricht University Challenge in 2022 has really helped us think about the business aspect. And also with the Brightlands Camelot campus, we were able to understand the scaling aspect of the technology, thinking about what TRL, so technology readiness level, we are at, and how to get from that to actually a commercialized scale, thinking about how big pilot plants we need to make, how big of demo plant, commercial plant, and everything.
I mean, that's fascinating to go from such a node of an idea into this network of different thought processes and how to build this out into something bigger. I'm just curious about one of the key points that you mentioned, which is actually like, who could we sell to, right? That's a very fundamental step in the commercialization process. So what has that answer been for Astrarium thus far?
You would think that the world's water scarcity problem means that everyone is your customer, but we definitely learned that that is not the case. You have to decide on someone who would pay for your service and who has a problem so grave enough that they would pay right now, or that the problem is super important for them to solve. And currently, our first customers would actually not be end users of drinking water, but rather be larger scale desalination companies, because we want to patent our technology and license it to them, because they would use our technology as a precursor of their existing system, because they already have the means to build such large facilities, which would desalinate millions of liters of water a day. And by having the economies of scale and having the funding for that, they would be building our plants and providing us with a royalty licensing fee for doing that. However, we've also talked to farmers from the Netherlands. Believe it or not, the water scarcity problem is actually very common in the coastal areas of the Netherlands, because seawater is rushing into the rivers and also into the groundwater, making groundwater or rivers not usable for agriculture. And rains are not really constant. It's very sporadic, so they cannot save the rainwater and use it later. And we have talked to a couple of farmers from the province of Zeeland, who is also very interested in buying our water eventually. So after we're licensing it, so these would be the first customers who would also buy our water.
It also seems like those are opportunities where there's more leverage, because the parties that you're selling to actually have the money to set up the plants in the first place. When you said precursor in their process, did you mean that they would use the Astrarium process, so to call it, and then their own as well, but that the Astrarium process would do most of the work before it moves on to their already established process? Is that what you meant?
Yes. So basically, right now, Astrarium can remove sodium chloride from seawater. That's the table salt. But also, seawater contains various other chemicals like potassium, calcium, and everything, which needs to be removed for human consumption. But that's not the case for the farmers. For the farmers and the plants, sodium chloride is enough. So for the larger scale desalination companies, they would use our technology to remove the sodium chloride, because that is also their biggest burden and where they use a lot of energy, because that's the most amount of salt there is. And then they will remove the rest and use it for drinking water and other purposes.
So you mentioned earlier that you guys are 5 times more energy efficient than the current competitors on the market. What are the kind of competitors that you guys are competing against?
We're more five times more efficient than, I wouldn't say the competitors, but the competing technology. So the technology that we're competing with is called reverse osmosis, where they use a membrane and they apply pressure to make sure that water passes through the membrane, but everything else stops before. And to desalinate larger amounts of water with using that, they expend a lot of energy. Another competing technology would be thermal desalination, which is not really widely used on this part of the world, more where oil is present in larger amounts, because in that technology, you heat up water and then you condense it. And to heat up the water, you obviously need to use fossil fuels.
Now we've really touched upon some foundational elements of Astrarium and more of the background information. but I'd be curious to hear what you guys are working on now and where you are in the process of developing towards a full-scale company.
Of course. So currently, we're developing our MVP. So we showed the lab of proof of concept at a 200 milliliter per day desalination scale. And now we're building a 1 to 5 liter per day scale. But at the same time, we're also raising our first round of funding, which would help us build a 50 liter per day MVP, which would basically be a scaled down version of what we want to build in real life. But we've also made large progress on the market side, as in we've obtained some letter of intents with people who would actually pay for our technology, and also have built a group of board of advisors with a lot more experience in this field of desalination, in the field of synthetic biology, the business aspect, and everything. So that's where we are right now today. And I am currently going to the lab. I'm full-time at Estuarium. I finished my studies in July, and I'm taking a year off to work on the startup full-time, develop this MVP, and also attend a lot of pitching competitions at the side.
And then you briefly mentioned funding. So about how much are you looking for to build this MVP into a larger scale?
We're currently raising 250,000 euros that we hope to raise through safes or convertibles. But we're also not opposed to direct investments because it's also our first round of funding. So far, we've just been using competition wins money, a bit of grant money from working with Zuid Universiteit, who've also been very helpful. And so we're raising 250,000 for this round.
And what is the approach that you're taking to find this money? Are you out talking to investors, or are you more talking to kind of the bank scene in this whole perspective?
We made the mistake of going to VCs, late stage VCs, and also doing this at much earlier part of our market journey. And although we did not end up making any deals, we learned a lot of things from going and talking to these people, because they invest only when we need 1 million, 1.5 million. That's their starting amount. But they gave us insights into thinking about how to approach the funding. And then we started moving now to earlier stage, so seed, pre-seed stage VCs, and also angel investors, because this amount seems to be right for the angel investor size. And thinking about the banks, we would actually be a bit early for them, because bank loans actually start when you know that you're going to make revenue in the coming year or so, which is not the case for Estuarium. We still need to scale up, and then our revenue starts coming in.
So how are you approaching these angel investors at the moment? Do you have someone who has a big list that shared that with you, or are you just finding these by yourself using LinkedIn or Google?
It's a bit of going to Google, and then they have the Dutch government is like endorsing a couple of angel investors. You have a list of 40, 50. Then you cold email everyone. Firstly, you go to LinkedIn to see if you have any common connections, because if you do, then you can ask them to introduce you to them, or just go ahead and cold email all of them, basically, with an email tailored to each of them. But also, we have found some angel investors through our network, looking at the people, because we also work at the Brightlands Camelot campus, and there are a couple of investors which constantly visit the startup hub for other companies, and they also point them towards us, and that's also how we are finding the angel investors.
And you also mentioned in the beginning that you guys are all a very technical team. You don't really have that much business experience. What are the kind of key skills that you guys had to learn as a team to connect with these angel investors?
The key skills that we had to learn was a bit more painful, I would say, because I, like the genetics business, did not come to me very easily in the beginning. But the financial spreadsheets that we had to think about, the forecasting, how much revenue we had to make, but also things like looking at the market and the customers, thinking about who would pay for your startup. Another thing that we had to think about was the exit strategy and the road to exit, and thinking about how we could get to that point. What are the future plans? Because we were like, we have to make this work, but then what after? What happens when it works? Where are we going from there? And basically all of that. So those were the things that we had to learn. And all of these incubators really helped us with that.
You also mentioned that you were getting quite a lot of insights about the approach to funding from a lot of these early conversations with the late stage VCs. What are some of these insights that you could maybe share with the audience?
A major insight, I would say, is to think about how we make the pitch deck that we approach to investors with. So thinking about the structure of the pitch deck and thinking about what to include, what to exclude, and also thinking about what happens when an investor is really interested, then they're like, can we have your data room? And we're like, oh shit, we have to build a data room. So thinking about all of those things so that we all have all of these set up before approaching an investor. So those were some key insights.
Yeah, that's exactly what we also got taught with Unshackled, is this difference between having a pitch that you're going to present and then having a pitch deck that you send to someone. And we also made the mistake in the beginning that we send the normal pitch deck that we present to an investor, but there's not nearly as much information as needed on a pitch deck that you present with.
And I mean, I didn't have to pitch that much with Disorder, but I can imagine that also a lot of people are always worried about what you put in a pitch deck. But I think also what you leave out is also actually a crucial part of the equation, not only for the sake of keeping it simple, but keeping people interested and also keeping some cards in some sense close to your chest that you can play later on during a negotiation or with the data room, for example, things like this. So I think, yeah, it's a good point of reflection for people going through that of what to include and what to exclude. So it's a nice insight.
So we've now talked a little bit about how you guys have had to adapt to getting funding for the company. But maybe on a more personal level, you're the leader of the company, you're the CEO. What are the first major challenges that you came across? And how did you really grow into your role as the CEO of Asterium?
Yes, I am the CEO of the startup right now, but I wasn't always the leader of Asterium. In the beginning, when the project started, I actually had a different role, head of science and communication, mainly because I was this first year who did come up with the idea, but had zero technical experience, zero lab experience. So I had to learn all of that in the beginning when it was the competition, when it was for the competition. And then after the competition, we had a conversation on how to take this further and everything. And there was a lack of leadership or someone taking accountability or responsibility. And I thought maybe I should try. And we had a couple of months where we did not really have a specific leader. We just had, I just was working a bit more. And then the team decided that maybe you should lead the startup. That's how I became the CEO. But although it has a lot of perks, one of the first things that I had to learn of being a leader is having these uncomfortable conversations. And also my first fire. Thinking about who leaves the team for the betterment of the startup. Because until that point, I was not even leading the team of the original company, original project. So I had to think about whose roles make more sense, whose roles are not really needed because it has already been filled. It was not a personal choice. It was just that someone else was already doing it. And so we just had to let them go so that they also had different paths. But also thinking about who would have been nice if they would have stayed, but they had to leave because they had different career opportunities or if they had different career plans in mind. So those were one of the first, lessons that I had to learn as leading the startup.
So building on this idea of having a team, just before we started recording, we were briefly talking about Asterium having some bachelor students on board as well, writing their bachelor thesis. That was kind of one look for me into the Asterium team. Could you maybe give our audience a bigger picture of maybe how many people are on there and the different roles and functions that go into building an MVP of a company like this?
Of course. So basically, we're three directors or co-founders, myself, Ani, Matisse, and Neha. We all three of us were in the original project for the iGEM competition. Then we have four team members, Sinan, who used to be a former co-founder of Eatly. He's still a co-founder of Eatly. Then we have Maho, who's Sinan is helping with the finance financial aspect. Maho, she's helping with the more permits and the genetic organisms that we're leading with, working with the government of the Netherlands, thinking about what permits we have to apply. And then we have Camilla, who's working on the engineering side of the project, building our first MVP, thinking about what equipment we need, what pipes, what pumps, thinking about how big of a scale and everything of that sort. Then we also have Lara. She was also there in the original team. And she is the branding manager of the startup, thinking about how we present ourselves to the world, looking at all the slides and everything that we pitch with, making sure that it's consistent, working on the website. And also she designed a really amazing logo. You should have a look at it. It's a manta ray, because manta rays usually live in estuaries. And also, sorry, a quick detour about the name of the startup. It's Estuarium, because estuary is where seawater mixes with freshwater. The Latin version is Estuarium. And these manta rays live in the Estuarium, and they look kind of like filters. So she designed her logos. Super cool. That's our team. Then we have a couple of students. So we have two students right now working from Zuid University, where they help with they're doing their minor projects on our startup. And we will soon have a student working from Maastricht University. And we also have someone working from RWTH in Aachen, helping us with the engineering aspect, along with Camilla, thinking about how we can build these bioreactors and the desalination systems.
That's a very cool story about the logo and the name of the organization. How did you go about finding team members that weren't part of the original group that you went to Paris with?
We didn't really go looking for them. We had a conversation. There was a spark. They were interested. They also had motivation to join a startup of sorts. And they just started working on the startup, and soon they became one of the necessary elements of the startup, and that's how they joined the team. So it was not like we were actively looking or like hiring people. We just ran into them. For example, Sinan, we ran into him at the Maastricht University Challenge of 2022. He was there pitching for his company, Eatly, and he won the startup award that year. And we talked, and he was very interested. Then we had a bunch of conversations back and forth, and then he joined the team. So basically, yeah.
That's fascinating. I think that spontaneous team building at the beginning, it's a lot of fun. It's also not usually how people expect it to go. They usually think it's a lot more professional. How do we find the right person? Well, it's usually just that they have this part inside of them that gets inspired by the idea. And that forms a bond and a connection that you build on. But then I was trying to keep up and keep count of all the names you were saying, about how many people are in the team at the moment. And then there were three people doing research, three or four.
So we are seven, the whole team, from the startup side. Then we have four or five students apart who are working on their thesis, also doing the research. But I'm also in the lab. Me and Matiz and Neha, they are doing their master's currently in Utrecht University. So not very far. So they also come quite often to have a look at the research and also do it on the side.
And then what does the day-to-day look like on your part, showing up to the lab? What are the kind of things that you're working on, if we can speak on that?
Yes, definitely. My day-to-day is just waking up, going to the lab, coming home and sleeping. that's the brief. That's how it goes most of the days. And in the lab, I am working on creating our version 2 of the project, basically, because the version 1 that we created for our proof of concept with the 5x energy efficiency has a bit of drawbacks in scaling. So what we're doing right now is building a version 2, wherein it would not only be scalable, but also be controllable. Something that I did not go a bit into before when talking about the technology was that how the bacteria take up the salt. And we actually have a light-based system wherein the bacteria take up the salt in green light and release the salt in red light, like a sponge, and working in this traffic light system. And firstly, we place these bacteria in seawater, turn the green light on so that they take up the salt inside. And then we move these bacteria to a lower volume and we turn the red light on so that they release whatever they took up and reuse these bacteria multiple times. We're building the second version of the system along with the export so that the bacteria are able to release the salt that they took up and also potentially have that as a revenue stream, but we're still looking into the purity levels of the salt and all of that. And at the same time, the version 2 will be more scalable, so we're growing our bacteria to a much bigger volume that we have grown before. And that's what my day-to-day looks like.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the process, not knowing that much about it. But what kind of factors create issues regarding scale? Is it the bacteria procreating and maintaining their population, for example? Is it the way that they consume the salt and how quickly it takes for them to then be able to let it go? Are these kinds of issues? Could you maybe expand a bit more on that so that we get a better picture?
Definitely. So the issues that we run into when scale would mostly be something that is specific for estuarium itself, not really for the bacteria, because the bacteria that we're using have already been grown to very large volumes to take up carbon dioxide from the environment. The thing that we have to think about here is that we are modifying these bacteria genetically, and we have to think about making sure that it's in a safe environment that they're growing. It's not in open ponds, because those would not follow the safety regulations. And another thing that we have to think about, as you said, is how fast they take up the salt, how they release it, and the stress that it creates with the bacteria. Because the bacteria that we use have been shown to live for 2 to 3 years, the specific one singular bacteria. But the stress might actually reduce their lifespan quite a bit because we're making them take up and release salts quite a bit. So those are the scaling up issues, but I think we're making progress towards them. And an advantage that we have is that the bacteria we're using are cyanobacteria, which means that they're green bacteria, and we really don't have to give them nutrients like glucose or anything. We just shine sunlight and they grow to larger volumes by themselves. So that helps a lot with scaling up the bacteria.
And then, I mean, estuarium is still quite young, but I'm guessing that there might be evidence out there regarding kind of the effectiveness of these bacteria over a longer period of time throughout their lifespan. Does it get worse in terms of how effective they are taking out the salt or the water, or does it stay relatively level?
Believe it or not, we're the first company ever to try using these bacteria to desalinate. They have tried non-transformed algae and other technologies to actually take up the salt, release the salt, but so far they've not been feasible. What they take 10, 15 days to desalinate, we can do within or about a day with the genetic modifications. And we kind of got lucky in the construct, I would say, a bit, because there have been some research groups which have been trying this concept for years. And some of the modifications that we did made sure that the bacteria don't die as quickly as...
Perfect. Yeah, so you can keep those populations for a long time as long as you take care that they stay healthy and don't put too much stress on them. That's it's fascinating. We're truly fascinating.
So you say now that no one else is using the bacteria like this to desalinate water. How do you go about patenting a process like this? Because the cells or the bacteria, can you patent that, or do you patent the whole process of it?
We can actually patent both the process and the product itself, because the bacteria that we're creating has never existed, and that is something unique that we thought of, so like intellectual property of ours. We talked to the RVO, so basically the patent people in the Netherlands, and we filed a search report to see if this exists around the world, and we got positive response in that we ourselves in the competition were one of the only places where they found a technology similar to this. And we will be patenting both the genetics aspects of it, so basically the bacteria which has this ability to take up and release salt in these light conditions, but also this whole process of putting the bacteria inside, turning the light on and everything.
She'll end up filing for 2 patents then in the end.
2 or maybe even more, depending on like if we're only looking at uptake itself, because that's a different desalination industry, and then the release could be the salt industry, which would be a different patent that we can license separately.
It's very interesting. You see that then one kind of process can lead to multiple different kind of IP strategies. Really fascinating.
All right, Ani, we're kind of shooting back and forth now. We spoke about being a leader and the lessons that you've learned from that down to your day-to-day in the lab when you guys are working out, and now we're zooming out again a bit more. Now, estuarium is definitely something that's evolving over time. How do you see that evolution playing out, and how do you see your role inside that evolution?
Estuarium currently is working on the desalination project, but at the end of the day, we don't want to be a large-scale desalination company making these big machines. because what I and what the whole most of the team is interested in is the genetics, biotechnology, thinking about how we can use genetics to solve problems. So right now we're working on the problem of desalination, and in the next couple of years that will be the case, wherein we develop a technology large enough to scale up and also patent and start licensing the technology, go around the world to make sure that people around the world get access to the water, because they may be closer to the seas, and seas are basically 97% of the water in the world. But after that, we're also thinking about moving to other projects, because we've been approached by companies, for example, lithium extraction companies for electric car batteries, because they want to take it out from seawater. Lithium is very close to sodium in the periodic table. They were like, maybe bacteria can do this. We were approached by feed companies, which want to make desalinated pig feed, so food for pigs. And they were like, we have this problem where it's too much salty. Can you remove it from that? Because the membranes get stuck. So the feed gets stuck on the membrane, so maybe the bacteria can remove it. We've put all those projects on hold, focusing on desalination first. But in the future, we aim to be a biotechnology company, creating technologies using bacteria genetics and showing it in scale and licensing it, basically.
That also sounds very much in line with not only the strategy you guys have employed thus far with the licenses and the patenting and working in that direction, but also really the larger story as a whole that you're telling, right? That you are more technical-focused people in the team for the most part, and that that's where the focus goes. I think that that's definitely an asset that you guys can leverage. And I think getting a know-how in the space of that interrelation between these kind of genetic modifications and the business world, I think that's a really strong place to be in. So I think that's a very commendable way to evolve Astrarium. Yeah, that sounds really exciting. I myself am getting excited listening to it, so that's cool. Yeah, Ani, you just laid out the longer-term ideas behind Astrarium. But I'm more curious about you as a person as well. What is your personal long-term vision, and maybe also the impact on the broader ecosystem and society at large that you kind of want to be working on throughout your career?
This is going to sound cheesy, but I would like to put my dent in the universe, because if you look at the really big picture, our lives are not that long. We're living, what, in 80, 90, if you're very lucky, 100, if you're really, really lucky. And the vast expanse of, like, how long the Earth has been, how civilization has changed. So I would like to change something, bring about a change, which hopefully is definitely positive, in that the world moves to a better place than it was before. And something that I also wanted to do since I was very young was do something of my own. And since I like genetics, something that I really am interested in is doing cool projects using genetics that I don't have to go looking for governmental funding or looking for only projects which will be funded if there's a clear goal. Of course, starting out with water scarcity, it's a very big problem. And by solving it and maybe making some constant revenue on the side, I personally would also like to work on some cool genetics projects on the side that would maybe not be really interesting to the investors, but is very fundamental research that we actually need for betterment of human life. So, yeah.
I mean, that sounds like a really nice way to, I guess you could define it as combine work and play, but still working towards a positive end. And I understand that you say it might sound cheesy, but to me, I mean, yeah, I think the only reason these things sound cheesy is because other people call them cheesy, but I don't think they're cheesy at all. I think it's commendable. And I think that when you look at younger entrepreneurs as well, that's usually a goal that really motivates us. So I think that's more powerful than people give it credit. And yeah, I'm excited to see what you build in the future.
So, Ani, we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guests to bring an object of significant value for them, either in their personal life or work life. So what did you bring for us?
I have brought this book called What's in Your Genes by Katie McKissick, because when I was very young, I don't read as much anymore, but when I was very young, I used to read a lot of books. And there was this one book that I once saw in a bookstore, and I asked my parents if I can get it, and they said yes. That was this book. And I read this book in 1 to 2 days, and I have read it so many times because this was my introduction into the world of genetics and the possibilities. And from this is where I looked at the YouTube channel, all the videos and everything, which helped me understand the whole genetic aspect. Before I was taught about it in schools, I used to be this nerd who had charts of his of genetics and genes in his house and everything. And this is an object of personal significance for me because this has kind of defined what I want to do in my life with the whole genetic aspect, and thinking about what I want to do with Astuarium too, because if not for this book, there is very little chance that I would have come to Maastricht or started a company called Astuarium.
That's a really wonderful example of an object, and quite an interesting and clear path to today. Probably one of the clearest ones yet that we've seen so far. So thank you for bringing it. Thank you for coming in today. Thank you for sharing your time. And we hope to have you back on at some point, maybe for a follow-up episode, and see where Astuarium is.
Of course. And thank you very much for having me on First Moves. Very excited.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for listening to today's episode of First Moves. If you want to connect with our guest personally, then make sure to follow us on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram, which is First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. It helps us improve our show and get better guests for the future. Thank you and have a great day.